All right. Hi, everybody. Oh, it's much nicer when it's up close. It feels less intimidating. Okay, I will speak louder and more into the mic. That better? Okay. Okay, so I actually have a title for this drosh. It's called Pick Your Promise. I love alliteration, so. Pick Your Promise, yeah. So I've felt kind of blessed this whole summer so far in how I've just been able to more easily spend time with the Lord because I don't have a work schedule that I'm trying to work around, and it's been really nice and different than usual, and he's been speaking to me more through the devotionals that I'm, like, it's just been really amazing to see things I read during a week or even on that day in the morning just speak directly to, whether it's conviction or encouragement or whatever, something that was going on the day before or that week or things. So it's been really encouraging to just spend the time with the Lord, hear him speaking through his word and also other people's writings about his word. And so some of what how this all started was that I was like reading through one of my devotionals, and it was about patience, which had come up last week. And so I was like, I sent it to him, and that's how it started. Right. I sent you the little, like, oh, this is the stuff on patience. And then you were like, oh, you want to do a drosh? And I was like, okay. but it was just overall a blessing to, and that's not something I normally, like, I don't know. Normally this is kind of an intimidating thing for me to be up here, even though I teach in a classroom. it's a different story. And this was, the preparation of it was far less fearful and more just like spending time with the Lord. And hey, he spoke some stuff to me, so maybe he's going to speak some tough stuff to you, sort of thing. So so pick your promise. Moses comes up in, or his death, his for future death is not future in our time, but future from that point is referenced in the Torah portion this week in Numbers 27:12. Where the Lord says to Moses, go up into this mountain of Abiram and see the land that I have given to the people of Israel. When you have seen it, you also shall be gathered to your people as your brother Aaron was, because you rebelled against my word in the wilderness of Zin when the congregation quarreled, failing to uphold me as holy at the waters before their eyes. These are the waters of Meribah of Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin. So Moses, his situation here is bitter sweet, I think. He gets to see in like a, almost like the way that Abraham is referred to in John 8:56 as having seen the day of the Lord and rejoiced in it. Let me read that. Your father Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day, Yeshua was speaking. He saw it and was glad. So it reminded me immediately of that situation, and just that he sees before him the promised land. And then he is told by God that he will not be, you know, or maybe he knew it before, who knows, but that he would not be entering it himself. And, you know, that's, that, if I were him, I mean, I could maybe see the, that was a consequence of my actions, but it would be really kind of a almost bitter thing. And so, but he stands out as a man with a vision and forward vision, even, because his response is, he spoke to the Lord saying, "Let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation who shall go out before them and come in before them, who shall lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be as sheep that have no shepherd." So he immediately, his response is, "Who's going to lead my, these people who I've been leading?" And the Lord answers him that Joshua will be the one. And he, this is right after the last passage, so Numbers 27, 15 was where I started just then. And the Lord said to Moses in 18, verse 18, "Take Joshua the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him. Make him stand before Eleazar the priest and all the congregation, and you shall commission him in their sight. You shall invest him with some of your authority, that all the congregation of the people of Israel may obey." So Moses has the promises that God has given him. He sees the, you know, from the top of the mountain, the promised land, knowing that the people are going to enter, even though he will not. And his response is to invest in someone else and invest in the future promise. And I think that in one of the devotionals from this week was so connected to this. Moses could have, like any of us could have, responded to that in a very different way. More taking it as an extreme loss and focusing on his personal loss of not being able to enter the land. And a section of one of the devotionals from that I had read this week was talks about loss, and I thought it was really poignant. So David Roper, I don't know who that is, writes, "Great sadness comes from catastrophic loss, and the root of that sorrow, it seems to me, is wanting something that we cannot have. At the risk of sounding indifferent and uncaring, the only way to deal with it is to let go of what you want but cannot have. To die to your right to enjoy good health, good friends, a trouble-free family environment, unconditional marital love, and golden retirement years. Dying is the only way to come alive." So, I think Moses could have decided to focus on that loss and dwell on that. And it was a personal loss. Maybe he would have been able to simultaneously hold dwelling on the personal loss while also looking forward to the future promise. But I think the future promise would have dimmed more and more if he had done that. And but looking instead at the promise and picking the promise of what he could stand on, that God had said, which was that they would enter the land and he would see the restoration of all things, et cetera, et cetera. This is a little bit projection, obviously, but you know, he and we can, putting that in view, just die to ourselves and our particular specific feeling of loss, or loss of, maybe loss is not the thing for you, maybe it's, I don't know, whatever, but I guess loss could be more broadly meant like loss of something that you wanted, or just kind of, yeah. So I think he could have picked the reference to pick your promise, I was thinking kind of like he had the big future promise, the real promise, and then he had what was in the natural, what seemed to be the momentary promise, the promise at the moment, which was that he was not going to be entering the land himself. And he had to, and we have to pick what promise, the promise of our mind, of our own creation that we, you know, see in the moment or feel in the moment, or, and that's kind of loosely defined promise, obviously, or God's promise to us and for us. In 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 5. Paul, or whomever wrote Thessalonians, writes, "May the Lord direct your hearts to the love of God and to the steadfastness of Messiah." Another translation says, "to the patience of Messiah." And I'm sure there could be long talks and time at length spent considering the patience of Messiah, which I won't do now because I actually only thought of it, even though it's the more obvious one, I only really thought of it at the latter part of when I was, thinking. Yeah. Okay, so that was 2 Thessalonians 3, 5. "May the Lord direct your hearts to the love of God and to the steadfastness," or the patience, "of Messiah." And so, I mean, in the, you know, what I've thought of it since then is just, he somehow embodied, like, actually it was referenced today in one of the readings, how he says he knows what is in man, fully, right? He has, like, had all of the knowledge of everything in him, and knew and could see the restoration of the world. Yet he was playing a really important part, but a part in the timeline of history at that time. And I mean, I can't even, it's just actually hitting me now, like, how you can do that. I feel like I wouldn't have the patience. I probably wouldn't have the patience. But he, you know, for the joy set before him, yes, endured the cross, but he knew it all. He knew the end of all things. He knows the end of all things, yet he played that specific part at that time. And that had got to require a lot of patience. So that's my thought on that. So then Colossians 1, verse 11. Says, "May you be strengthened with all power according to his glorious might, for all endurance and patience with joy, giving thanks to the Father who has qualified you to share in the inheritance of the saints in light." And I actually ended up being led to that through another devotional book that, like, has paraphrase translations that he often uses, and so I had read the translation and I was kind of like, oh, I don't remember that ever being, and so I looked up the verse, but the Colossians, I want to read what it, yeah, so the way that the NCV, whatever that is, translates that is, "God will strengthen you with his own great power so that you will not give up when troubles come, but you will be patient." The phrase that I got out of that, or the what I felt like was coming out of that for me, was his power will give us endurance and patience, which will manifest in joy and thankfulness. And that led me to, like, just be thinking about the fact that thankfulness seems to be the antidote to everything that I could possibly, like, I can't think of something that thankfulness isn't the antidote for. And his power, not our power, his power will give us endurance and patience when we think we don't have it, won't, you know, it will be difficult, whatever. And that we'll know that we have that if we are being joyful and thankful. And then lastly, Romans, that was Colossians 1:11. 1:11. And then Romans 8:18. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. And that passage for me kind of put a nice cap on everything that the Lord had been speaking to me. And brought it back also to our desire placed from him in us to see the redemption of the world and to see a restoration of all things. And you know, that can be painful at times, and that can be when we see something that is the antithesis, or, you know, apparent and well, is the antithesis of it, not that it's not all leading toward that, but that can be difficult. But we hope for what we do not see. We wait for it with patience, just as Moses and Abraham did. And we need to pick what promise we will choose. We need to pick what promise we'll choose. No, we need to pick what promise we need to pick the promise that the Lord has given to us and hold fast to it. And in his time, we will see the restoration of all things.
So this is perfect. Jerusha's given you a whole bunch of scriptures that I don't have to give you. And God obviously has kind of dovetailed this together. So I have a title too. This stash oink or whatever is called Double Encouragement for Despair. So it's interesting that you were speaking about patience and hope. And when I read 1 Kings 19, the parasha for this week, I'm reading some of these things in the Tree of Life version now, and so it's all very new and fresh to me. I try to read things in different versions at different times, and sometimes it's just life events, sometimes it's what you're reading that causes things to stand out. So we read this all together earlier, but if you want to follow along, just turn to 1 Kings 19. We have the scene where Elijah's just done great things, but this evil woman, Jezebel, very, very evil, has basically put a price on his head. She has told him, "I'm going to kill you." And in spite of having just called down fire from heaven and seen all of the false gods put to shame and the altar consumed, he fears. It says in verse 3, then he was afraid and he arose and went for his life. And then he gets to the point where in verse 4 he says, he's lying down and he says, it is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my fathers. And he lay down and slept under a broom tree. So this is the picture of somebody who has let fear grip his heart to the point that he is in despair. This is not just, you know, mild depression. This is total despair. He has no hope whatsoever. He just wants God to take him. And he does what people tend to do when they're in despair. They lie down and they go to sleep. He becomes unable to do anything. And what struck me this time was the angel touches him and says to him, arise and eat. And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water, and he ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, arise and eat, else the journey will be too great for you. And I was realizing this is not a second meal. This is actually the first food and drink that the angel brought. And I was picturing somebody who's in such despair that when an angel of the Lord comes to them and says, I have provision for you, he takes a little bit and he's so despairing that he just gives up halfway through and he just goes back to sleep. And God does not come in to condemn him in his despair. The angel encourages him again. Get up, eat and drink. And so he's able to do it. And so really what the Lord was showing me was something about the nature of despair and in part how we help a brother or sister who's in despair, whether we discourage them by becoming angry with them or quoting all kinds of verses to them, telling them what they should or should not do. It's interesting, God didn't speak scripture to him or tell him to meditate on something. God simply provided something for him. He actually gave him something tangible. And when even that encouragement wasn't a strength, because it was despair, God gave him a double encouragement. So then he finally gets up, and he's not going to die under this broom tree, but he goes and he hides in a cave. So he's been provided for. God's encouraged him enough to get out of the despair, enough to go somewhere, and he's hiding in a cave. And God says, what are you doing here, Elijah? And Elijah pleads his case. Look, God, you know what's going. Life is hopeless. Look at all that's wrong. And God says, go forth and stand on the mount before the Lord. And we have the strong wind, we have the earthquake, we have the fire, and we have the still small voice. And then in verse 13 it says, and when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. So he's inside the cave. God has spoken to him, telling him to go and stand upon the mount before the Lord, and it doesn't seem like he did that. Because it's finally, after all of this, he goes out to stand at the entrance of the cave, and the voice comes to him and says, what are you doing here, Elijah? Same thing. Come on, I'm trying to help you out here. And then Elijah gives the same exact story. He tells God of his troubles again. So I'm not seeing God condemn him. I'm not seeing God tell him what he should have done. I'm not seeing God saying, Elijah, how can you possibly be discouraged? Didn't you see what I just did? And I'm thinking about our tendency when we hit believers in a point, you know, we come in contact with them at a point of their weakness, they're discouraged, they're depressed, they're maybe even despairing. And what do? We start telling them why they shouldn't feel what they're feeling. God doesn't do this. God encourages. He goes to them. He provides. So the Lord says to him, go out to the wilderness, and he tells him what he's going to do. And then what's interesting about what he's going to do is two more doubles. He's so it's like he's so keyed in to Elijah's need for extra encouragement that he doesn't just give him one thing, he gives him two. So he says, anyone who escapes from the sword of Hazael, Jehu will slay. And anyone who escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha shall slay. I've got you covered. Don't worry about these people. I'm going to have you anoint two people, not just one, because we all know that by the time some of the guys are slain, you're going to still be fearing and possibly be downcast. So I'm going to make sure you understand. I'm in sending two encouragements. And then when Elijah comes to Elisha, it's almost like he has internalized this. He throws out the mantle on Elisha, and Elijah runs to him, but he says, let me go back, you know, let me say goodbye to my family. And he doesn't chastise him for wanting to go back and take care of things before coming to follow him. He says, go and do it, and then come back to me, and he does. And so what interested me about the verses you shared, Jerusha, is in 2 Thessalonians 3:5, it says, may the Lord direct your hearts. Not may you pick up your own heart and try and direct it, and not may your well-meaning, believing friends come and tell you what your heart should be feeling, but may the Lord direct your hearts. And then Colossians 1:11, may you be strengthened, not may you be criticized, not may you be minimized. May you be strengthened. And then in Romans 8:18-25, it talks about, for in this hope we were saved. And that's where Elijah is at. He's in this hope of the Lord, and that's where he's saved. And if you read back on one more verse past where you went, it says, likewise, the Spirit helps us in our weakness. For we do not know how to pray as we ought, but the Spirit himself intercedes for us with sighs too deep for words. And he who searches the hearts of men knows what is in the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for the saints according to the will of God. So I just believe that the Lord is saying that we do have that hope, and he understands that there are times in our lives where we cannot grab hold of that hope, or where we may be ministering to another who is in a position where they can't grab hold of that hope. And that our job as the God with flesh on is to be a double encouragement to those who are in despair, to be praying for them, that the Lord would strengthen them, that the Lord would lift them up, not teaching them, chastising them, directing them, telling them how they ought to be, you know, well, you're a believer, you ought to be overcoming, you shouldn't feel this way. God didn't do that. God simply provided physically, tangibly, and encouraged and spoke words of action into Elijah's life. And all of those passages that you read talk about God doing the work. And when God does the work, then yes, in hope, we patiently wait for what he has to give us.